Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thanks very much for joining us today. Now, I just had the opportunity to talk with Jia Li about her new book, Shanghai Homes, Palimpsests of Private Life. This came out with the Columbia University Press in 2015. And not only is this the first time that I've ever had a chance to interview someone who turned an undergraduate thesis, if you can believe it, into what is an amazing book, but also this is a book that I really couldn't put down. So it's a book that takes us into Shanghai alleyway homes of the 20th century by focusing on alleyway homes and their resulting neighborhoods that Jia was part of growing up, or that her family or people who her family knew or that she knew were part of over the course of this history. And it uses an exploration of these homes in a very cinematic kind of a way, and in a very, very moving and evocative way, to take us into different ways that these homes and these houses were spaces for the production of private lives, were material environments, were sensory environments, were environments for the production of memory and narrative and gossip. It's just a really, really wonderfully wrought and wonderfully written book. It's also a book that's full of amazing stories, and you're going to hear some of my excitement about this. I'm sorry I can't really contain that over the course of the next hour. But also, I mean, I just really encourage you to get a copy of the book and read some of these stories yourself, because they're, you know, we can't possibly do justice to them in the course of a conversation, but there's, you know, stories of, we've got evil stepmothers. We've got people buying, stillborn babies to eat them as medicine. That doesn't come up in the conversation, but that happens in chapter 2. So look for that. You've got stories of some amazing women who struggled through some really, really difficult, very challenging personal circumstances, and some stories of some really fascinating, really funny, just really alive human beings in this book. So it's a book for you if you're interested in Shanghai, if you're interested in homes, in family history, in modern Chinese history, in urban history. It's a book for you if you're interested in the idea of private life, but also if you just really like a good story. So it was really a pleasure, as is, I hope, completely obvious, to read the book. And it was also really a pleasure to talk with Jia about it. So thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Jia Li about her new book, Shanghai Homes. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Jia, and thank you for both making time to talk with me today and for writing what was a really, really beautiful and really, really thoughtful book to read. So welcome, and thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Carla, for having me. Can I actually just take this occasion to say thank you for putting this program together? I have been a fan for 3 years, and this podcast actually made my very mundane daily chores of doing laundry and cooking into really sort of intellectual occasions, and I learned so much from the program. So I want to thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Well, and also, so thank you, because without people writing amazing books like this, this program wouldn't exist. So, Jia, can you start us off, as is kind of traditional for the channel, by saying a little bit about what brought you to the field? How did you decide to come to work on modern China as your kind of academic field of specialty?
So I came to the United States from China when I was 11 years old, and I think throughout high school, actually, I was the my teachers would always ask me to talk about China, and that made me ask my parents and grandparents many questions. Initially, when I went to college, I thought I was going to major in creative writing and English, and then I tried also anthropology, and I thought about film studies. I tried out all these different concentrations and majors, but then decided on East Asian studies because it's very interdisciplinary. I feel like I still have a certain obsession with China, because I wanted to find out more about the experiences of my families, their friends, especially being kind of a 1.5 generation an immigrant. And I feel like there are many memories that have been left behind, and I wanted to understand them more. So I was was very drawn to courses in modern Chinese studies in various disciplines. And I think I pretty much stuck with it. But I couldn't decide on a particular discipline initially. But eventually, when I came to graduate school, I wanted to do literature, film, and cultural studies. This is sort of the modern China aspect of it. But, yeah.
That's awesome to hear. And it makes a lot of sense to hear that you're interested in creative writing, anthro, and film studies, because you can really see in the book that we're talking about the kind of really wonderful transdisciplinarity of the work that touches on all of these fields that you've mentioned and these kinds of practices. So, yay.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, yeah. So the book explores the history and culture of Shanghai alleyway homes by focusing on two physical spaces. Both of them were built in the early 20th century by Japanese and British companies, and both were located in the industrial Yangshupu district in the eastern part of what was the international settlement in Shanghai. And there's lots of stuff going on within that context that we'll get to over the course of the hour. But first, can you kind of say a little bit about what brought you to this particular topic? How did you come to work on Shanghai alleyway homes?
So this project is actually, the book is originally based on my undergraduate thesis.
That blows my mind. I just need to get that out there. This is the first time in New Books in East Asian Studies history that that has been the case. And I just am still getting my head around that. But anyway, I'm sorry. Go on.
I actually did not think I was going to write a book at that time. It was really because ever since I lived in these alleyway homes, and the two sort of alleyways are actually the housing compounds where my maternal grandparents and paternal grandparents each lived in for over half a century. So I knew them very well from my childhood memory. And I had been also writing stories, fiction and nonfiction, about these places throughout high school and college. So when I was trying to choose a topic for my undergraduate thesis, I thought perhaps I can take that occasion to really consolidate what I have done over the years, and also as a way to record the oral histories of my grandparents and all their neighbors. And they would actually take me to visit other neighbors. So I had quite a number of interviewees at the time. And this was also a point when I became very interested in film and wanted to actually do documentary filmmaking. My mentors at the time, Professor Liu Li and Eileen Chow, they actually both encouraged me to take a camera along and then perhaps make a documentary of my summer research. And so I started conducting extensive interviews, actually in the summer of my sophomore year already, and then more extensively in my in the summer after my junior year, in preparation for the senior thesis. So, and I found that many of the stories that my interviewees told were oftentimes not actually not quite the same as what I learned in available scholarship or textbooks. So I was very happy to finish the thesis at the time. But then when I was enrolled in PhD program several years later, and then one summer I returned to Shanghai, and my grandparents told me that actually the alleyway that they lived in was being demolished. And so we actually went to look at the demolition site. And all of a sudden I realized at the moment that this demolition worker was wielding almost like a sledgehammer and kind of knocking down the balcony where we used to, like, that sort of evokes so many memories, I realized that actually perhaps I could turn this thesis, the stories that I have collected, into a book project, because I think there are actually many photography books and architectural historians have also written about this particular form of architecture in Shanghai that is disappearing. But very few people have really concentrated on one neighborhood and written down the stories of one neighborhood. So I started wondering at the moment of the sort of the demise of these alleyways that perhaps there's some value in the oral histories that I have collected. And that's when I decided that I wanted to turn this into a book.
So what was that process like? Can you talk about any of the kind of major transformations or major changes or other aspects of the process of turning this into a book from an undergraduate thesis?
So as an undergraduate, I was utterly undisciplined. And I switched between different majors there were also elements of creative writing in the original thesis. I was not very rigorous about my methodology. I didn't really think very much about how I was conducting my research. And I also did not compare notes between my interviews and sort of more historical sources. So I went back to the interviews and really read up on this, all the relevant scholarship in architecture, in history, in anthropology, to look at the issues that scholars are more concerned about. I guess the main change is really to make this stand up as a scholarly book rather than a collection of reminiscences that I happened to collect when I was in China, and also really to cross-examine my sources, because in many ways, I realized that afterwards that some of the stories that they told, for example, about when the Cultural Revolution began in Shanghai, when they began to notice my interviewees sometimes misremembered history. So it was important to go back and make sure that but even the misremembering is interesting. Sometimes I wanted to really bring that out as well. So that's one major change. And another is really to engage with the existing scholarship and to think about what issues might be of interest to scholars in other fields as well.
And there are these kind of moments of really, speaking of this misremembering, some of the stories that you recount in here, which are kind of told in the voices of the people who you're talking to, there are some really wonderful moments where, you know, you can kind of see as a reader this process of one of your interviewees saying something like, you know, there's this moment, oh yeah, if the Japanese caught you playing mahjong, they'd make you like eat the tiles, right? And then you have like this, in parentheses, somebody else saying that actually isn't true. You know, they're coming back and there's this kind of wonderful, I think, play with that, the kind of memory and conversation that actually comes out of some of these interviews that you record for us. That's really, really wonderful.
Actually, sometimes I feel like when my grandmother says things like, well, actually the counter-revolutionaries really suffered. They were just like the communists in the pre-revolutionary days. I think that's also a very revealing. Of course, the counter-revolutionaries or rightists are not like communists in terms of their ideology. But when she makes that comparison, it tells us a little bit about her worldview, her view of human experiences, and how to her the sort of the pariahs of society are those who had been oppressed because of political circumstances. I find that these moments of misremembering actually quite productive and interesting.
Absolutely, and sort of in the way that you're recording traces of multiplicity in the context of these remembrances, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you have multiple voices like chiming in with different perspectives in the course of the same interview, it really, I think, gives quite wonderful textual and documentary shape to the importance of this kind of multiplicity of memory and the productive capabilities of misremembrance.
I think that's actually why I wanted to focus on a neighborhood rather than just my own family, and also even to look at two sides of my family, because my paternal grandfather was labeled a rightist. He's more of an intellectual, and he went to St. John's College in Shanghai, and then but you know, because of his intellectual background, he felt very much persecuted all of his life. But my grandmother, my grandparents on my mother's side were workers, so they really feel like they had been saved by the communists. And the juxtaposition of the perspectives of these two sets of grandparents, I think also gives a more sort of nuanced picture of how people experienced history. And I try to do that also, particularly in the chapter where I talk about the Cultural Revolution in the alleyway where many people's homes were ransacked by Red Guards. But I also have the perspective of someone who was in charge of a home search and, you know, his perspective on things, and also the audience of the children at the time who found all of this very entertaining. So I think the I'm hoping that this kind of juxtaposition can be illuminating for understanding how people experienced history in a given community, rather than just sort of one class, or focusing on one class or one individual or one family.
Right. Yeah. Now, already in what you're describing, you're kind of touching on at least two of the really important methodological contributions that the book is making, and that the book mentions kind of early on in these early chapters. So in thinking in terms of juxtaposition of stories and juxtaposition of images, this evokes the very cinematic aspect of, and I say that in the best possible way, right? Some very cinematic aspect of a lot of the book. And you talk early on about the importance of video work for the project, right? And you mentioned kind of taking a camera. I mean, this is actually, this resonates in different levels, and I'm sure we'll kind of talk about that in a moment, right? Mm-hmm. You talk about treating research material as footage, and the importance of kind of cross-examining interview subjects. Can you talk a little bit about that, about sort of video and thinking in terms of video as it shaped how you were both producing the book and also kind of thinking about the potential contribution of the book?
I went into my research actually thinking I was going to make a film. I ended up making a very small film about my my paternal grandparents only. But the way I collected about 60 hours of interviews, and in putting it together, I was thinking about it in terms of what a documentary filmmaker would do in presenting this information, partly also because I wanted to make it very accessible and very readable. And another kind of, because one of the inspirations for the book was actually a film called City of Sadness by Hou Xiaoxian, where there are a lot of long takes and long shots taken from of a family's everyday life, and sort of a lot of emotional residue is accumulated in the process because we keep on seeing the same scenes again, but then their birth, their death, there's war and there's peace. A lot of history actually happens in the background. So I thought about when I was filming people, not only collecting their oral histories, but also the mise-en-scène of their homes. So the decors, the settings, what do the different artifacts of their homes actually say about them? And then when I asked to see their photo albums, that's usually also an occasion for them to remember the past and talk about, and it's really a moment when they can speak about their memories. So I used these I used film as an interview method for the most part, but also as a structuring device for the project as a whole.
Now, in your invocation of the importance of the accumulation of emotional residue, mm-hmm. this actually speaks to something you mention also early in the book. You call your approach to research here excavating where I stand, right? So, and this
yes.
idea of excavation is really interesting. It also evokes one of the terms that's in the title that's really crucial, which is the idea of a palimpsest.
Right. Yeah, that is my favorite word. I used to joke that if I were on my gravestone, I would want, if I had one word, it would be palimpsest. And but I think that because the word, I think it sort of brings together a number of different disciplines. A palimpsest is a text, right? It is a text that has been, it's a manuscript that has been written on and partially erased and then written on again. So it has multiple layers. So, but there's a sort of a material texture to that text. So I can use methods from literary studies for a palimpsest text, but at the same time, it evokes history, the notion of history, because it's there are multiple dimensions of time. And then it also sort of the materiality of it and the idea that urban space can be like a palimpsest also allows me to really treat these homes as palimpsests. I guess one of the this really occurred to me when I interviewed my my paternal grandfather over the summer, and at that time I was about to graduate from college, and I actually didn't know he went to college, but he said, "Oh, I have a diploma," and then so he actually has a whole string of keys that he carries with him all the time that jangles when he walks, and his house is actually quite small, but he locks up everything. He's quite paranoid. And so I always thought there might be a lot of secrets. And one of those secrets actually turned out to be his college diploma. And he took it out, and it's St. John's College, quite a prestigious college in Republican era Shanghai. But what was very surprising to me is that he had made red crosses all over the diploma. So he vandalized his own diploma. And when I asked him why, he said during the Cultural Revolution, he was afraid that his home might be searched. And this diploma written in English might be taken as evidence of his collaboration with imperialists. So he decided to denounce himself preemptively, but he didn't want to throw away or destroy the diploma. So he just made crosses all over it. And then when I looked at that document, it's very yellowed and brittle, and then he was kind of holding it and laughing and crying uncontrollably, and I thought that actually this piece of document, it's from 1943, but it also has markings from 1966, and as he holds it and sort of rereads that document, he's attributing meanings from 2000 as well. So one can also treat a home as a similar kind of artifact that bears traces of their owners over time. And by excavating those traces and by sort of really digging into these traces, I'm trying to find out the meaning of history for people like my grandfather, but also more generally. So also the idea of excavate where I stand is that I'm trying to make an argument that one's own family or people that you know very well, that usually in scholar as a scholar, one should not use very personal sources. And I wasn't as aware of that as an undergraduate, but in turning this into a book, I kept on thinking, what does it mean to have this kind of subjectivity in the book? And I feel that because there are certain kinds of information that are very private and very intimate that you can only get if you are a member, an in-group, if you're part of the, if you know the people very, very well, because if you're coming from outside and doing interviews, they may not be able to tell you and what they really think, but also like because I know my interviewees so well, I have spoken to them at multiple occasions, and also like meals and other silences and their paranoia are manifested over time. So I wonder if one's own family could not also be a source of valid scholarly inquiry. And this is what I'm trying to do in the book. And I'm actually quite curious about how it will be received by historians and anthropologists.
I mean, I can't imagine that there is not going to be an overwhelmingly positive reception for this, in part because the book doesn't just kind of touch on the, you know, the fact that you're related to some of these, you know, people. This is about your life and your family as well. It embraces that, right? It sort of proceeds from that and owns that and makes that part of the story in a really wonderful way. And I think one of the ways that this really works is that it lets you get at one of the other really important and touchstones and kind of threads that link the different chapters of the books. And this is the idea of a private life. So throughout, and, you know, we'll talk about this over the course of the chapters, but throughout, the book is defining private life in a particular way. It's advocating for the importance of thinking about private life in the context you're talking about, and it's investigating several dimensions of private life. And you call them private territories, private artifacts, and private narratives of history. Mm-hmm. So let's actually get to some of those territories, right? And let's get to footholds. Now, the first chapter introduces us to the two homes that are under investigation in the book, and it introduces them in terms of housing, like as they functioned as housing for families and for individuals in an increasingly crowded city. And you're looking at a sort of the idea of foothold. You're looking at these homes in terms of square meters, right, in terms of physical space, in addition to other things. So this chapter takes us through the stages of these homes as foothold from foundations in the early 20th century all the way through the 1970s and 1980s. So to get us started, just to kind of give us a glimpse for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, can you just kind of lay the foundation, so to speak, and describe what we need to know early on about these two homes to be able to follow kind of what comes next?
So both of these alleyways were built in the early 20th century. So one was built in 1927 by a British real estate company, and the other in 1915 by actually a Japanese cotton mill. They actually commissioned sort of shatoku-like housing compounds for their employees, particularly Japanese employees. And with the British housing compound, the name of this lane or alleyway is called Youbangli, or Alliance. I translated it as Alliance Lane. I was very lucky to find the a woman whom I called Grandma Apricot.
Oh, I love her.
She actually moved there with her family when she was a little girl, and she had lived there until its demolition in 2006. So she actually I was able to find out a lot about this housing compound from her between the years of like 1933 and 2006, because she married someone who was also in this alleyway. So she gave me an account of what life used to be like, and how her grandfather and father, like how a multi-generational household used to live in one house, and how after 1949, because of the many of the bourgeois families who used to live there, as you know, they were either small capitalists or they were working as managers for particularly the British American Tobacco factory that was next door. Many of them also had silk factories. So these small capitalists and sort of compradors for foreign companies used to be quite well off and had one house per household, basically. But because a lot of them had lost their sources of income after the communist revolution, they had to sublet the rooms as there might be five households by the mid 1960s, five to eight even in some houses, that homes that are actually designed to accommodate just one family are now inhabited by five families at the time, oftentimes consisting of workers, intellectuals, also old people who used to be capitalists. So it's actually a very, very diverse community. With the Japanese housing compound, I wasn't able to find the original residents, even though in the Shanghai Municipal Archives, I was able to find a lot of the material about about the transition of enemy property after 1945, after the Japanese surrender, and they all moved out. So this housing compound came under the ownership of the state, and then they were redistributed to Chinese employees of the cotton factory. So I was in the first chapter, I was basically trying to trace how these spaces have been used and owned by different families over time. And Shanghai, because it is housing is such a major issue for so many families, especially actually by the late 1970s and 1980s, when the generation of who used to be children born in the 1950s, when they came of age and needed to have families of their own, but there is no housing for them. In the case of my paternal grandparents, they had to sort of divide the two rooms that they had between two children who were getting married in them. And my grandfather actually he was reduced to living in a closet under the staircase for quite a few years. So the housing shortage and all the domestic conflicts that this generated is what I tried to chronicle in this chapter, but also in terms of entitlement to housing, especially in the socialist period.
And this chapter really also highlights the importance of different media of memorializing the space of a home. And so the reader gets access to these sort of phenomena, this early history, and this actually continues throughout the book, not just through photographs that you give us and stories, but also through drawings, right? I think there are lots of drawings of these spaces by your parents. Is that right?
Yes. I was very lucky. My parents were, of course, very supportive of this project from the beginning. And so that's one of the nice things about when I try to explain the spaces in words, I realize it's quite inadequate. It's very difficult to do this. But my parents drew sort of the plans of these homes and also what life used to be like based on the interviews that I conducted. So you can see this in the actual book itself.
That's right. Now, we could easily talk for the rest of the time just about this chapter, mm-hmm. but there are three more, and that's about six.
Yes.
I just want to mark for listeners just some of the really important things going on here, and then sort of ask you mm-hmm. to talk about some of the others. Now, these families that you mentioned are not just multi-generational, but they're also polygamous, right? In certain, or I think you
yes.
kind of use that description, and that's to say you're not just living with your father and your mother and your cousins and, you know, some other children, you're also potentially living with your father's concubine, right? And
yes.
Their children. And there's some really wonderful stories that are recounted in this chapter, including Grandma Apricot, who, you know, I just loved after the photograph on page 51 and her discussion of that, where she kind of takes us into this photo from a spring outing to Hangzhou in 1949, where she's talking about this whole story. You know, that was my father's concubine, and she's holding this baby, and here's what happens afterwards. And it becomes a story about this kind of evil stepmother, and it's just fabulous. It's really just fabulous, right? And there's a lot of stuff like that here. So we're introduced to Ye Ye and Nai Nai. And, you know, Ye Ye's writing criticisms of himself during campaigns and sort of ceding part of the house to the Housing Management Bureau and their downstairs neighbors, including the Wus. An old Wu had surgery that frustrated his sex life and he beat his wife. And there's all this stuff happening, right? So we're like in this space of just like amazing stories. There's also a description here of illegal structures. That brings us into Aunt Pearl's shanty. And Aunt Pearl is another fact. Can you talk a little bit about Aunt Pearl, actually, before we move on? Because that's a fabulous, a really, really fascinating story itself. She lives in this kind of illegal structure that's built onto the house. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so when I first became interested in housing, I was looking up all this description of Shanghai architecture and how it's kind of a museum of world architecture, and then all these different architectural styles. And then when I walk around Shanghai, I realize that the kind of architecture that really is pretty ugly, but very much dear to people who live in Shanghai, are something called illegal structures. So they're basically these tentacles or like these sheds and shanties that people build on top of existing housing to accommodate the excess population. And the one of the first shanties that were built in my grandfather's the old Japanese housing compound, which used to be quite beautiful with front yard and a backyard with garden and everything, but because my grandfather Yeye had to give up the downstairs the entire downstairs living room to a worker family because he was labeled a rightist, so he felt like he couldn't have so much housing, and he had a daughter, my aunt, she was paralyzed basically from the waist down. So when she got a little bit older, it became very difficult to carry her up and down the staircase. And so my grandparents started petitioning the housing bureau to build a little shanty for her in the backyard. When they finally got permission, their downstairs neighbor would not allow this because he said there was actually a fig tree in the yard. And so they first had to build the shanty around the fig tree. And then, when he moved away, they took the opportunity to expand the territory so that she could actually have a room of her own. And even though it's quite haphazardly put together, and the room is actually freezing and over the winter and quite damp, it becomes home to her for many years. So even though it is one of the most sort of eyesores of Shanghai's landscape, and you can see still many illegal structures, but I would almost like readers to think of these kinds of structures as home for many of their inhabitants in times of gross housing shortage.
That's right. And Aunt Pearl's story also is a little window that opens up sort of wider and wider over the course of the book into not just a history of home and what home can look like and feel like, but also a history of disability. And of gender, right? I mean, there's this mm-hmm. story of her like trying to get a job in this workshop in an alleyway, and a guy before hiring her, this guy wants to watch her go to the toilet to prove that she's reliant or to prove her independence, right? That she can.
Yes.
They're just these amazing moments of that are unbelievable almost, but that, you know, really are just touching and striking and I think really, really important, even beyond thinking about just the story in terms of home.
Yeah, my grandmother used to always say, if only she had lived to this day, you know, when disabled people are much better treated in China today than back in the 1970s or 1960s, when she was not allowed to go to school or really get a job. And so,
That's right. So if that chapter looks at the home as foothold, chapter two considers home as a haven and a refuge. Mm-hmm. And this is a haven and a refuge defined by boundaries of privacy. Now, there's a lot of amazing things happening here, but one of the really interesting sections of this chapter is one of the first sections that looks at domestic artifacts as historical mm-hmm. witnesses. And you introduce us to Weigong and Weipo's grain bed, Yeye's writing desk, Nai Nai's sewing machine. We have photographs on the eight immortal table, and we have a radio.
Yeah.
To give us a kind of flavor of what's happening here, can you kind of choose maybe one of them that's perhaps particularly evocative to you at this particular moment, for whatever that is, and just kind of take us into one of these objects?
Maybe since we're doing a podcast, maybe I'll talk about radio.
Radio.
Yeah, I guess I'm very interested in the soundscape of the alleyway as well, and I wanted to know about the history of radio in this place. And my grandfather said he when he first came to Shanghai, he was very envious of the radio that his boss had, because he was always very curious about hearing news, and he could still recite some of the songs that were played on the radio at the time. When he became a state factory worker with quite a bit of disposable income, one of the first appliances he bought was a radio, and he bought it from Grandma Apricot's grandmother, Grandma Apricot's mother, who used to like use the radio as a way of keeping her company in the days when she was pretty much trapped at home. She wasn't really allowed to go outside as the wife of this manager. And then because of this bourgeois family of Grandma Apricot could no longer afford to keep up their past standard of living, they started to pawn off everything, including this radio. So my grandfather actually bought this radio. And I was sort of also looking up what kind of programs there were, like what was on the radio. And it was really interesting to find out, for example, that in Shanghai, in the Republican period, there were 60 private radio stations. And then after the communist takeover, they all became abolished. And eventually, there were really just Central People's Radio Broadcasting Station and the Shanghai radio station. And every morning at a certain hour, they would broadcast the music for doing gymnastics. And this is something that everybody who lived in China would experience in schools or work units. Everybody would be doing these broadcast gymnastics. So radio also came to regulate people's bodies. And then my grandfather actually, but one of my own memories of radio is actually from the late 1980s, when particularly in 1989, during the Tiananmen protests, I was in Shanghai. I really had no idea what was going on because I was a 9-year-old. But my grandfather would listen to a transistor radio under his pillow every night, and he would listen to a program that would turn out to be Voices of America, and then which reported incidents that were completely different from what I heard in the morning from the Central People's Broadcasting Station, which he would play at full volume. So it also made me aware of a certain of like hidden voices and a kind of an undercurrent of voices that was happening in the alleyway that is oftentimes whispered. So there are these two kinds of radio. And when I actually imitated the sounds of the radio to my grandparents, they were quite shocked and said, don't do this at school. But I think in some ways, this the realization of these different stations and different voices made me see that what we hear in the mainstream historiography may not be what people are necessarily hearing or paying attention to in their domestic lives.
Absolutely. And this is, incidentally, I'm teaching a class right now in which we're reading the Diary of Anne Frank. And there's this, I don't know if you've had a chance to, but there's this, all of these resonances, you know, sort of attentiveness to living together in this particular space, the importance of the radio and kind of the radio becoming part of household life. There's just, I mention that because for listeners who are interested in, I think, teaching courses and seminars, who are looking for kind of cross-disciplinary, trans-local books that might be put together for larger histories of home or of kind of materiality of home, but for lots and lots of different ways, I could imagine your book being taught alongside some of these other books in ways that could create really, really interesting conversations, like The Diary of Anne Frank, for example.
Well, thank you. I never made that association, but that would be amazing.
It would be an amazing course to teach. Yeah. I would love to take that as a student too. But so materiality continues to be really, really important throughout this chapter. We won't have a chance to talk about all the ways that this is true, but I'll just mention for listeners, there's this really, I think, moving and very kind of striking discussion here of home searches. And you talked a little bit about that, I think, a little bit earlier, this sort of struggle sessions and what's happening to the alleyway in the context of the Cultural Revolution. And there are some descriptions here, not just of the experience of these home searches, right, of sort of having one's personal space violated in a way by these searches, but also some really kind of surprising and interesting accounts of the exhibition of some of the items that were confiscated, right, and of kind of clandestine reading that went along with this. There's also sort of moving from here, and I know I'm speeding through this ridiculously, so listeners, read all of this closely. There's so much that I'm not talking about. There's also a discussion of kind of interior decoration, right? You talk about the ways that aunts and uncles are using interior decoration to reinvent what you call petty bourgeois privacy in Shanghai homes. And we meet an engineer of the human soul here, Aunt Treasure.
Yeah.
Now, Aunt Treasure, do you want to talk a little bit about Aunt Treasure? I mean, Aunt Treasure is kind of hilarious in this section of the book.
Well, she was quite a revolutionary. She, after she graduated from college in 1968, she volunteered because my father at the time was a volunteer to go to the Northeast and, you know, support the Sandown movement. And my aunt said that she was going to become a teacher in the most remote borders of the country. So she decided to go to Xinjiang and become, and she calls herself the engineer of the whole human soul. And, when she came back to Shanghai to visit my grandparents in the 1980s, and my uncle had just gotten married and redecorated the, his marriage chamber with all these new appliances like a wash machine and a refrigerator and all this, and also like my aunt had a she brought a dowry of these beautiful blankets and also her dresses. And then when Aunt Treasure saw that that my uncle's wife had, his new wife had many pairs of shoes, so she was outraged. And she said that even the professors at her university did not have so many pairs of shoes. And, you know, what does she think? Who does she think she is? And so there was quite a bit of domestic drama over the materialistic consumption of the, you know, what she called petty urbanite, in a very derogatory way, she called my aunt. And then, but some years later, by the time I interviewed her, she herself is very proud to announce that she has a lot of pairs of shoes as well. So her values have completely turned around. And her husband is now, you know, running a also a company. So, and she says, well, capitalists work actually much harder than workers. So so I thought that she's quite a character who can actually bring out the changes in people's the way people look at material consumption over time. And and I also feel like in the Cultural Revolution, when there was no privacy allowed ostensibly, but it's, for example, with the bourgeois objects have been put on exhibition to show the shamelessness of, I don't know, capitalist mistresses or something. A lot of the people who are viewing the exhibitions actually are amazed at the quality of life before the communist revolution. So the reception of these exhibitions may be quite contradictory to the intentions of those who staged them to begin with. And actually several of the worker households, they were buying these things like nylon stockings and even short-sleeved woolen sweaters from the pawn shops, secondhand shops, because they're such beautiful objects, even though they're not really going to be wearing them at home. But something like the short-sleeved woolen sweater is bourgeois because it's not about protecting your body from the cold, but rather for fashion purposes, right? So so those are also some of the, I'm very keen on sort of documenting the fashion sense even of the Shanghai residents over time and how this changed and developed over time. Mm-hmm.
So after we move, or after we explore the rest of this chapter, which includes, and I just have to give a shout out to Growing Pains, the TV show Growing Pains.
Oh, yes.
There's this really great discussion of the sort of the ways that some of these families are looking to foreigners on TV for cues to home life. And Growing Pains is one of the shows they look to. And I'll just say, they weren't the only ones who were trying to learn how a normal family, quote unquote, U.S. worked from Growing Pains. I remember that myself. But then we move into a chapter on gossip. So chapter 3 focuses on neighborhood gossip and family lore. And as you put it here, home is a site of memory and storytelling, and it's haunted by ghosts. Now, in part of this chapter, you approach the alleyway space as what you call a milieu for gossip. And this section of this chapter provides a tour of your own childhood alleyway home. And it shows, among other things, how the alleyway can become a kind of theater for everyday life. And that's another theme that for listeners who are interested in reading the book and tracing themes throughout, the theme of theater is actually one that recurs. Now, you take us into some moments in this tour, including introducing us to the eyes of Grandma's front bedroom. These names are great, right? The communal kitchen and the faucet room, a dark staircase with four light bulbs.
Yeah.
Now, just to kind of maybe open up this part of the book a little bit for listeners, for you, can you kind of think of one of those moments that might have been, or and might for whatever reason right now be particularly evocative for you? And maybe just talk about that a little bit to bring us into this part of the book.
I was interested in how the alleyway space itself might generate narratives and generate storytelling, because I felt that many of the stories I was hearing from my interviewees have very much to do with the architecture itself. And I felt that, and I was wondering why there would be so many stories, even when I was trying to do like fiction writing classes, my memories always go back to the alleyway, as opposed to my later life in the United States. And one thing I realized, for one thing, like when you're entering into the alleyway, like whenever a peddler comes, or, you know, if someone buys something from a peddler, then it already is a communal event. And you find out a lot about people's, their domestic economy through, what they buy and how they bargain. Back also in the late 1990s, many families didn't have telephones. So there was a communal telephone at the entrance of the alleyway. So every time someone got a phone call, the entire alleyway would find out who got a phone call, because the public telephone person would shout, and also mail as well. So the traffic that goes through the big alley and the alleyway branches is already generating a spectacle of some kind, and people are always poking their heads out. And then also, because of the tight space, people are sharing a kitchen. So five families might be sharing a communal kitchen, and you would find out exactly what each family is eating at a certain time. And from the smell of what they're cooking, you have a sense of their culinary nostalgia. You have a sense also of their native place origins, also what kinds of food they need, or, you know, from the smell of fresh milk, or from the cooking milk, or of medicine. You also know somebody is sick in the family. So it's a very central environment where, when people live in close proximity to each other, they can hear, they can smell, they can see each other's lives. It really generates a lot of gossip in the process. And so these are some of the things I have in the tour. Really, I take the readers step by step through from the more public spaces into the most intimate spaces. So the last place I really stop at is a wall, a very thin partition between what is called the front bedroom and the back bedroom. This used to be actually one room, but a partition was added to separate two households. But of course, you can hear everything through this partition. So even for children who are living there, they find out very early on about the intimate lives of their neighbors and their so it's it can be actually quite destructive to people's mental well-being as well, to live in such close proximity with each other. Almost like they hated each other intimately, their many neighbors. I try to discuss that in the in this chapter called Gossip.
Now, we also find out about the intimate lives of some of the figures in the book. And in particular, there's a really beautiful set of discussions of women on the margins. Mm. So these women had come to the alleyway through marriage or through concubinage. They lost their husbands, as you describe here, to the revolution. And they took on kinds of work like night soil collection, kind of underpaid work, despised work. And these stories include the story of Mother Mao, or Moth, and her husband. And you sort of, as you're reading through, you really kind of feel like you want to meet these people in person, right? She's got this husband who visits brothel and he eventually gets syphilis, and you're sort of, you know, reading through this story and thinking like, how, what an amazing human who had the strength to sort of get through this. And there's also Mother Yang, when, you know, she has an affair with Mr. Xie and all this stuff goes down, and then she eventually remarries, but she's this beautiful woman. And it's just, the, you know, we won't have time to talk about all of this, but I just wanted to kind of mark this for listeners. There are some amazing stories in this part of the book. One of those amazing stories is the story of Aunt Duckweed. I cannot let you off of this Skype conversation without talking at least a little bit about Aunt Duckweed. Now, we get a glimpse here of Aunt Duckweed's family drama in a single-room home from the 1950s through the 1980s. And in addition to kind of telling us stories about her life, you also give us stills from your experience filming the ruins of that home, right?
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about this? For you, what are the most important aspects of Mother Duck, or rather Aunt Duckweed's story for the book, or the work that this part of the book is doing?
So Aunt Duckweed's story, I was actually find it very difficult to talk about. Her story is, of the people who read the book, they always tell me that this is one of the most moving stories in the book. And perhaps also because it is actually not really related to the political history in any way. The sufferings of her family do not have to do with political persecution or anything like that. But she actually talks about the life that is lived in between in a one, like a 14 square meter room where her mother and father and three children, and where she herself spent the first 26 years of her life. Her father was a silk worker, who was actually a fan of, movies, and was always, very assiduously like buying film tickets for everyone, and also a very generous human being. They lived quite well, and the mother wanted to be just, she was also a worker, but she preferred to be a housewife. So she actually took prolonged sick leaves for many decades, and was, but then she became quite obsessed with money, and was always sort of arguing with Aunt Duckweed's father over family finances, and to the extent that when he was dying in the late 1980s, and she was obsessed about this imaginary $10,000, 10,000 yuan that he had put away, and she was searching all over the house for it. So it is actually a very painful relationship that the parents had with each other, and all of this is chronicled in the her story to me, and it made me. I think this is her story is actually one of the reasons why oftentimes when people write about these alleyway homes that are disappearing. It's the narratives and also the photographs are very much couched in nostalgia. But I also feel that she really, her story really brought out the pain of what it means to live in such cramped quarters and to have, to also to be stuck in a really unhappy marriage between her parents. And her story is also about how she got out of the alleyway and secured a space for herself as a single woman. I'm not sure. I can't quite do just. I feel like this is a. I try to talk about Aunt Duckweed's story many times, but I feel that it almost needs to be read.
Absolutely, yeah. I think we can. All we can do now is just give a very brief oral snapshot of a much, much richer and really, really worth reading part of the book. And so this is. So listeners, I hope will go to that part. We'll read the whole book, right? But we'll go particularly to that part of the book. Learn about and meet Aunt Duckweed. And this is Aunt Duckweed's story is also another element of this ongoing history that's kind of under the surface of the book of moments of disability, the history of disability, because Aunt Duckweed kind of talks about, right, sort of how her mother may have had kind of mental illness. And so it's this, so I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, her mother and brother, and then actually in one of the application essays to the Housing Bureau that her father wrote, one was that there are two mentally ill people in this, this one room that we're living in. So he was applying for more housing, and of course he never heard back.
That's right. So as we come to the end of the book, and there's no way we're going to have time to do justice to the end of the book, but let's at least touch on it. This is, there's a fourth chapter that looks at the decay, destruction, and afterlife of the two houses and their neighborhoods. And this is a chapter called Demolition.
Yes.
So beginning in the 1990s, Shanghai cityscape, as you take us into in this part of the book, underwent some major, major changes, including a sort of a push toward urban renewal that ruined or erased older neighborhoods and some of the neighborhoods that we've been learning about and sort of in different ways and momentary ways inhabiting along with you and your the figures of the book over the course of the book. Now, the chapter focuses on your old childhood neighborhood, and among other things, it takes us into your visit to the old neighborhood in July of 2011. So as a way to just kind of get a glimpse of some of this part of the book, can you maybe talk about that a little bit? For you, what were maybe one or two of the most important aspects of that visit for listeners who are interested in understanding how to contextualize this part of the book?
I think the chapter Demolition is probably the chapter that interests people who are interests most people who are concerned about sort of Shanghai's urban sort of the physical changes of the urban landscape, because this form of sort of lane housing or alleyway housing used to accommodate this sort of 70% of the city's population, and now they're quite rapidly vanishing. And what happens with demolition of a given neighborhood is that the residents are often moved to the outskirts of the city, and then in the place of the old housing in the place of the old alleyway, new skyscrapers would be built. And this was originally done by having developers come in, and they hire these demolition and relocation teams who try to move the residents out by giving them the minimal amount of compensation possible, or sort of swapping, giving them houses, housing that's more in the suburbs, and moving them into the. So I went to pay a visit to the old kind of the ruins of that neighborhood in 2011, and my own childhood alleyway had been torn down already for a couple of years, but the neighborhood next door was still undergoing this process. The way these demolition teams work is that they try to convince the households to move one by one, and every time a household agrees to move, they actually tear down that one house instead of like getting everybody's permission. So it means that some of the people who have not agreed to move are living amidst the ruins of other homes that basically living in a state of rubble and having electricity sometimes cut off. And so the people who refuse to move at the end are called nail houses. Because they want better compensation oftentimes. So when I went back, I saw one nail house that was four stories tall, and mostly actually it's illegal, part of the illegal construction, because they had built three of these stories when they learned that this neighborhood was going to be demolished. So, but they wanted compensation that measured up to how much they had. And then on top of their house, they actually put many flags, like sort of Chinese national flags, and also a loudspeaker that sometimes played on the international, and also a lot of slogans that were critical of the government. So, and then they described to us several times when the demolition and relocation squad kind of tried to relocate them and try to empty the house so that they can tear down the house and then make them move to the suburbs. They actually prepared all these weapons, or, you know, like kind of their own homemade to defend this fortress of a nail house from the invasion of of the demolition team in order to get better compensation. They were basically like almost risking their lives in order to, it's actually a quite an ugly scene. I was quite shocked at the way that this whole process, because I feel like nail houses have also sometimes been portrayed in the media as very heroic, because as if they are defending, like kind of the movie Avatar becomes read in a Chinese sense as sort of the conflict between nail homes and developers who are coming in to tear down these old communities. But I realized that the nail home that I saw in this area, and also from other interviews, that oftentimes it is not about the preservation of the old community, but rather about maximizing their the compensation that they can get. So it is a very corrupt and also a violent process that everyone talks about. So these homes have turned into a last kind of economic capital, and they're trying to get the most out of them in order to sort of accommodate the many desires that they have. And I mentioned in the end that many of these nail homes actually are related to the idea of the selfless boat spirit that was promoted together with the Leifeng study from Leifeng campaign, because for most of the socialist period, private desires are suppressed, and it is the sort of everyone had to think of the public, and the individual to the revolution is like a boat in a machine. And so the boat spirit was actually very much promoted in the propaganda. But those who had been displaced, for example, to the countryside because of the Sandong Youth Movement, and they come back and they feel like they need to be nail houses now. They have to sort of have a stake in their own private interests, and in order to defend that. So I make a connection between the boat spirit and the nail homes that you see quite a bit in Shanghai today.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jia, thank you so much for spending the time to give us a glimpse of this really wonderful, very, very moving and very thoughtful book. There's also a coda that describes your giving Ye Ye and Nai Nai's things to a recycling man that I'll just point out for listeners. It's also very moving, and I think it's a really touching way to close the book. Now, there's a lot we haven't had a chance to talk about, right? And then, of course, a conversation like this can't be comprehensive, but is there anything in particular that we didn't talk about that you'd like to mention for listeners?
I think we covered quite a bit. Thank you for this opportunity.
No. Of course. So now that the book is out, and congratulations, is there any, or what are you working on now? Is there anything right now that's particularly inspiring you, and what can we look forward to reading next?
I'm trying to turn now my dissertation into a book, and I have a draft of every chapter, but I'm still working on it. So this project is, the title is Utopian, the tentative title is Utopian Ruins, a Memory Museum of the Mao Era. And it takes an idea from the writer and public intellectual Ba Jing, who called for a Cultural Revolution Museum in 1986. And this wish for a Cultural Revolution Museum actually has been repeated over and over by many intellectuals over the decades, but it has not been realized. But taking that as an idea, I wondered what would it be like to actually build a memory museum devoted to the Mao era? What should one exhibit? So the project has right now, like, it has sort of three parts. The first part is called Dossiers, sort of devoted to the Dang'an of individuals that have been rediscovered, including a woman who had been imprisoned in Shanghai and was writing in her own blood. And her story has been sort of revealed through a documentary film made in recent years, but her, she kind of provided a testimony to her own persecution, and I explore how her story became kind of an icon, or it became a mnemonic device to refer to many political campaigns throughout the Mao era. And then the second part is called Utopian Visions, and it deals with visual culture and visual legacies from the Mao era. So one chapter actually focuses on photography from the Great Leap Forward and the absence of photography of the Great Leap Famine. And another chapter focuses on a documentary film that Antonioni had made in China in 1972 and was denounced and was the object of a campaign, a political campaign to denounce the film. And the final part actually is about, it's a survey of the memory landscape of the in China today of the Mao era, including the ruins of old socialist factories, as well as existing museums and memorials that are devoted to the history or the culture of the Mao era. So I'm still at work on this, and I hope that it will be done in the next year or so.
Well, that sounds amazing, too. So best of luck with that project. I look forward to talking with you about that when it comes to. And thank you so much, Jia. This has really been a pleasure. It's an amazing book, and I'm really grateful to you for making the time.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.